It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with a guest about improving science education in the United States.
First, we take a look at a proposed co-sleeping bill that got a hearing today at the state capitol.
Under the proposed legislation, parents and other caregivers deemed intoxicated could face criminal charges if a baby dies or is seriously injured because of co-sleeping.
Joining us now is Shemaine Mills, WPR's reporter who covered that hearing. Shemaine, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So you were at the hearing today at the Capitol. What did you hear?
Well, a lot of groups showed up, a lot of nonprofits interested in the welfare of children. You had a doctor from the Medical College of Wisconsin. You had supporters of the bill, not only the lawmaker who's proposing it, Samantha Kirkman from Kenosha, but a Janesville detective who said he's followed up on a number of these cases, and he thinks this law would help reduce the number of infant deaths.
Did you hear people who were opposed to the bill?
A number of them said they were opposed to the bill. It's a very laudable goal in their opinion. Everyone wants to prevent infant deaths, but they see a number of unintended consequences and problems. For instance, parents who were co-sleeping might be reluctant to admit they're doing so if they face a felony, a possible felony for injury or death of their child. Those who support the bill say, well, we don't know how many are doing this, but if we prosecuted, maybe we would have those statistics. So it cuts both ways.
Now, the bill is being brought forward by Republican State Representative Samantha Kirkman. What was her reasoning for pursuing this legislation in the first place?
Well, she says a district attorney actually asked her for this legislation. She talked about a case in which a father had drank a six-pack, then come home, and he and his small child were on the couch, and the child died. And she said, this is needed to prevent people from doing it. It might have a deterrent effect. And in her opinion, this is very preventable. It's like getting in a car driving drunk. That was the analogy she made.
Now, on the other hand, I suppose supporters have long said about co-sleeping, you know, not under the influence of anything, but sober co-sleeping, that it's good for bonding with the child, that there could be some physiological benefits to it. What about that with a bill like this?
That was not brought up. However, there are a number of websites where mothers talk about the bonding, the convenient breastfeeding. It helps the child fall asleep easier. And the author, lawmaker Kirkman, said she was very careful to point out she's not banning co-sleeping in this bill. She's not against co-sleeping. She's just against co-sleeping in this particular instance where it's considered more unsafe. And that was a point brought up by doctors and others. Co-sleeping is considered unsafe by the American Academy of Pediatrics. However, it is popular. They don't know how many mothers or fathers do it. There are no firm statistics. In fact, one doctor said it could be anywhere from 20 to 80% in Wisconsin.
20 to 80. So they have, yeah, pretty wide margin there. I wonder if we have a sense, though, in Wisconsin, how many deaths are attributed to co-sleeping under the influence.
Well, in Milwaukee County alone, they've had 15 deaths due to co-sleeping. Now, the medical examiner there estimates about 20% of those may be due to drugs or alcohol. But there are also other factors that can influence whether a child dies during their sleep. Loose bedding, a soft mattress, smoke, secondhand smoke. So this might be hard to prosecute, and that was the one thing brought up during the hearing. The law may be on the books, but how much it will be used is another matter, if of course it passes.
And now, as I understand it, some people who are a little skeptical about enforcement have said, how do you know if someone, for instance, was drunk when they slept with their baby initially? Because when they wake up, they've metabolized the alcohol, and by, you know, a breathalyzer test, what have you, they're no longer intoxicated. So how can you tell?
Well, Representative Kirkman said in her county, Kenosha County, they actually ask the parent at the scene for a blood test. Now, that in the law right now, It's not written like it is for drunk driving, where if you refuse it, it's assumed you're guilty. So that is something still being worked out in the bill. Would they voluntarily give it? If they don't, what are the repercussions for that? And as you pointed out, if this you come across the scene hours later, there may not be alcohol in their blood. So another difficulty for prosecutors.
There's also an education requirement in the bill. What do we know about that?
Well, it requires a number of entities give out these prepared materials talking about the dangers of co-sleeping while intoxicated or impaired. It even includes 10th through 12th graders, which
really?
Is interesting. So it would be part of health education in schools. It would also occur in the hospital. It has to occur 7 days before you're released from a hospital. If you have a birth at home, a midwife or whoever delivers the baby would have to hand out these materials that have been approved by a state board.
Now, you mentioned earlier that 15, I think you said, co-sleeping deaths in Milwaukee County this year, was it?
This year.
So is this bill aimed expressly at Milwaukee?
No, in fact, the author, the lead author, is from Kenosha. A number of these deaths have occurred in Milwaukee County, most of them. And that's, of course, where you've had a major effort, including a television and radio campaign in 2011, considered very provocative, aimed at reducing or ending this practice. But it happens statewide. Samantha Kirkman cited a case in her district. The Janesville detective brought up several cases there in Rock County. So it's widespread.
It's statewide. Well, what's next for the bill? What happens next?
Well, it has not been scheduled for another hearing, so they're still trying to get more supporters and talk about this issue more to hopefully pass it.
All right. Well, Shemaine, thank you so much. We'll be watching this with you.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Shemaine Mills. She's a reporter here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up next, a look at improving science education here in the United States. You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, printers from around the country are gathering in Two Rivers this week. We'll hear about old school printing presses, font making, and more.
First, the New York Times science section rounded up a bunch of ideas on how to improve science education in the United States and get students at all levels more engaged. Our next guest answered their call, and she's here to share her ideas. Catherine Drennan is a professor of chemistry and biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you.
So you focused in your piece on the way science is taught, in particular the historical method. And I remember that from some classes where we learned who discovered what, when, and how. I could see some upside, but what's the downside of that approach?
Well, it seems like the subject only happened in the past. So if you're only telling people about discoveries in the 1800s, they may think that, you know, chemistry is like Latin. It might be a sort of an intellectual pursuit to learn it, but there's no sort of use for it today.
And another thing you mentioned is that it may keep a more diverse audience away from getting interested in science. Why is that?
So there are a number of studies that show, say, for a lower socioeconomic class, that having seen kind of the direct applications of the thing they're studying to careers is important. They want to know what this is used for, how this is going to help them have the career that they want to have. And if you're talking about things that happened way in the past, it's like, well, I'm not looking for a job in the 1800s, so why should I know this now? And for a number of women, studies show that there's a good predictor of staying in the major if the women see the relevance of this material to everyday life.
Now, you've got some outreach programs going on, and I'll get to that in a minute. But when you're actually teaching a science class, say, to undergraduates, how do you incorporate this idea into your teaching?
So I teach freshman chemistry at MIT, and what we started doing first is we just tried to present some of sort of what is current research in the class and just describe it and say who is doing it and why. But then we took a sort of a step beyond that and said, could we have the people who are actually doing the research, the undergraduates, the graduate students, tell about why they think this basic chemical principle is important and how they're using it for a real-world application? So we came up with this idea of sort of 2 to 3 minute videos where we would just kind of go around campus and find students who are willing to talk about their research and videotape them and bring those videos into the classroom and say, you know, this undergraduate may live down the hall from you and hear why he thinks that acid-base equilibrium is an important topic.
Well, you've also shared a lot of those on your website, and I pulled a few shorter excerpts from them. Let's hear Stephanie Sidlick. She's describing the work that her research team does.
The research that we're perhaps the most well-known for sensing explosives such as TNT. New, bigger, better explosives have been developed, and two of these are RDX and PETN, and these kind of have more bang for your buck, if you will. Unfortunately, they have an even lower vapor pressure than TNT, which means there's even less molecules of the explosive in the air, and it makes them even harder to detect.
So in the rest of that piece, she goes on to describe the chemistry behind how her team tries to detect chemicals used in the processing of these explosives. So I've got to wonder, does a student get a lot more excited about learning the chemical equations and the chemical formulas when they associate it with detecting explosives?
Yes, our data definitely shows that once you tell students why this is of value, and even if they're not particularly interested in that application, the fact that there is a reason to learn it, that someone is using it for something that's important, has a tremendous impact in their desire to learn it.
How have you been researching the impact, how that affects students?
So we've been working with the Teaching and Learning Laboratory here at MIT to design surveys and also so we've been collecting data from surveys but also doing interviews with the students who have sat through a class where, you know, in half of the class there were no videos and the other half there were videos, and sort of asking them questions about the learning impact and of the lecture and their inspiration. And it's really been very informative. And so I'm not an expert at that. You know, I'm a chemist, but it's been absolutely great working with Rudy Mitchell, who is at the Teaching and Learning Laboratory, who's a PhD in education, and talking together about how we can assess the value of this.
Anecdotally, what do you hear from your students? Are they saying, hey, this is way more fun than I would have thought?
Yes, they are. And, you know, I actually started the class telling them, I confess that I did not like chemistry the first time I took it. In high school, I didn't see the relevance of it. And so later, I had a wonderful college professor, and I was interested more in biology, and I didn't see that chemistry was relevant. But then when I saw the relevance of chemistry, it just completely opened my eyes and really changed my life. And so I tell all of them, you know, everyone finds their love for chemistry at some different point in your life, and so I'm going to help you in this semester see if we can help discover your love for chemistry if you don't have it yet. And so, you know, some of the quotes we've been getting are really, really wonderful. One of the things the student said was, these students on these videos, it wasn't like some godly researcher that you would never be close to. It was like, okay, this is a person. I could probably talk to this person if I met them in real life. That was kind of neat. So they had this sort of, I don't know what they thought exactly chemists were before this, but then when they were seeing these students, they're like, yeah, I could be friends with that person. And so that's a wonderful thing. And many of them also comment about how young they were and that they were doing really important work. And that made them think, I could use chemistry to do something really important because I look like that person and I'm interested in that. And I want to solve the energy problem, or I want to detect explosives. And I'm learning these things, and it's basic principles. So maybe I could do that too.
Huh. Well, that first example we checked out there was somebody describing her work. I've got a couple more, and this is the other half of the video thing that you're doing, of people talking about their love of chemistry. Let's first listen to a bit of Hector Hernandez.
I did not know that I was always going to be a scientist. I grew up in a household where there was art and there was history and there was languages, but there was never really science. But I remember watching TV when I was growing up and seeing Jack Cousteau and the man go up to the moon and all these other things that really, really sparked my excitement.
So why is it important to hear a personal story like Hector's to engage people in chemistry or other sciences?
So we decided to do do the personal stories partly because I had been involved in a program at MIT where high school teachers came and I was giving them a tour of my research laboratory and telling them about the research we were doing so they could kind of bring that back to their classroom. And they thought that was great, but they would stop and sort of interview the students in my lab and say, well, how did you decide to come to MIT? And, you know, what was your background before you came? And they really wanted to take back to their students that, you know, some of these people at MIT, you know, they got a B once. You know, there weren't necessarily straight A students, or there were no scientists in their family. Just because you have no scientists doesn't mean that you can't go to MIT. These students had all sorts of different backgrounds. And so they were so fascinated by the personal story and they wanted to share that with their students. We thought, well, while we have these students on camera, let's ask them, you know, how they ended up at MIT, how they got interested in science. And we had just these 12 people picked based on their science they were doing, and all the stories were different, and it was completely fascinating.
We'll listen to another story in just a moment. I also wanted to invite listeners, if there are science teachers out there or science students, to head over to our Facebook page, Central Time on Facebook. How do you think we can improve the way we teach and learn science in this country? What are you doing in your classroom? That's Facebook. We're Central Time on WPR. Going to give a listen now to another a bit of another personal story from Nozomi Ando. Let's give a
when
listen.
When I was younger, I read a lot of comic books, and I read a classic series on ninjas. And I really wanted to become one, actually, as a result. I really liked the idea of having a long apprenticeship and becoming an expert ninja, and I'm trying to apply that same sort of philosophy to science.
I love that one. She wanted to become a ninja, and she saw parallels in science and ninjaism, if that's a word.
Yes, I think that it's actually, I hadn't thought about it that way until I heard her say that in the video, but it's true. I mean, it is an apprenticeship, and you do sort of learn from the master as sort of the professor in the lab and in the environment, and it is. There's not too many other things like that where, you know, as a graduate student, you finish taking classes, you're really in the lab learning about the research world and studying under somebody to become an expert. And it is like that. And it is it's a real fun way to think about it.
Now, you're at MIT. I think of this as one of America's brainier science type colleges. But do you think these lessons will work at the high school level? You mentioned high school teachers a minute ago, even mm-hmm. at the junior high level, say.
You know, I think it will. We have been talking to a number of high school teachers and showing them these videos, and the reaction has been, you know, hugely enthusiastic to have these sort of little snapshots in that connect, you know, just sort of a list of what are applications of chemistry, and they can look through them and say, you know, we're interested in sort of diagnostics for cancer, or, you know, alternative energy and all these different things, and having this to inspire people that this is important what they're learning. But, you know, also these stories, and I think what's so important is that very few of the people that we interviewed said, you know, that they had any idea kind of starting off that they were going to end up at a place like MIT, and they all had these different paths, and that, you know, it's not sort of this, you know, this sort of faraway, mysterious place that, oh, I would never be smart enough to go there. Most of the people here thought that. You know, so if you're passionate about science or you're interested in science, you know, you shouldn't set limits for yourself, you know, see what you can do. And I think those stories will be, I hope, really inspirational to students at all levels.
Well, it seems like what you're trying to do is kind of have this big mindset shift from, yeah, I've maybe taken a couple science classes, but scientists are fundamentally unlike me, to maybe I'll be a scientist, maybe I won't, but it's within the realm of possibility. That could be me someday.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we want people to see themselves as scientists and see that there's all sorts of different scientists, and the things that we're doing are relevant and interesting. It's not a dead subject. It's a vibrant subject that is going to be – it's so important. There's so many problems facing this world, and we need people with chemistry skills to go out there. And one person did say about the videos that – I saw that there was an actual impact in what they were doing. They were changing the world. That's important to me. So we hope more people feel that inspiration to go out and tackle the tough problems of the future with a solid foundation in science and math.
All right, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Drennan. She's professor of chemistry and biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Up next, Wisconsin hosts a festival devoted to the printing press. It's the annual Ways Goose this weekend in Two Rivers. We'll find out what that is and get a taste of printing past and present coming up after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, roller derby is growing in popularity, and Milwaukee is playing host to an international championship this weekend. We'll find out about the sport and the event later on.
First, Wisconsin is also playing host to a national event for the world of printing, font making, and typesetting. It's the fifth annual Ways Goose, hosted by the Hamilton Woodtype Museum in Two Rivers. Museum Director Jim Moran joins us. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks much, Rob. I appreciate it.
So before we get to the big event, I wanted to ask you, you are in the midst of completing a big and somewhat unexpected move. You had to find a new home after your old building was sold. How's the move going?
Well, it went well, considering. Really what you had to do, Rob, is move about 12,000 square feet of museum equipment and type, as well as about 25,000 square feet of stored equipment and type, and then, of course, find a place to move it to, because when we were told that we had to move, we had no clue where we were going to end up.
And I'm no expert on printing, but one thing I do know is that presses and collections of fonts are really heavy. This is not just an invite the guys over for some beers and move you. This is a big deal, right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, I've been a printer my entire life, so I had experience moving presses, but typically that didn't involve 27 semi-loads of it, which is what this amounted to. And so the museum's got a staff of two, and that means that you'd better be really creative in terms of figuring out a way to get it all packed and safely brought to a new space.
And you're just about ready to be open to the public?
Exactly. We had to be out by the 1st of April. We begged our way into another month, and then we got everything over here by the 1st of May. And so since then, it's been fixing and painting and cleaning and unpacking and moving and moving and moving. So we've got everything in. We aren't where I would like to be for the opening of the museum, but, you know, it's like Christmas. It comes whether you are ready or not, so you just kind of gear up and go with it.
Well, you've got a big inaugural event here. The Ways Goose, one of the weirdest words I've said. What exactly is a Ways Goose?
It originates as an old English term for a year-end printing event. There are two descriptions. One of them is an apprentice throwing a banquet for his fellow printers at the end of the year with the principal dish served as a goose. And then the other is more of another year-end event, but it's kind of repulping the leftover paper to cover the windows against the onset of winter, which is still followed by an event. And so, we kind of keep to the tradition, but over the years, printers have kind of played a little bit loose with the term Ways Goose. But It seemed apt for a year-end event that we have held for 5 years now.
When people think of printing, if they do, they probably think of desktop publishing with computers or maybe a massive printing operation like Quad Graphics here in Wisconsin. Tell us about the scope of the world of printing that you cover at an event like the Ways Goose.
We really begin with the traditional Hamilton method, which is letterpress. And roughly speaking, you are pushing the type into the paper. So while we certainly discuss that history and we have presenters that do that, we also have people who bring the complete opposite end of it. So those who are digitizing type for desktop use, as well as any number of aspects of it. So we've got a wonderful printer from England coming over to talk about her letterpress work. We've got a great guy named Ken Barber coming from House Industries in New York. They take more of a digital end of it as well. One of the world's best type designers, Eric Speakerman, is coming from Berlin. Alan Haley of Monotype will be interviewing him. So we really try to pull from both backwards and forwards because printing is a very movable occupation, and therefore to dwell strictly on the past would be kind of a mistake. We like to encompass as broad a base as we can. So we're bringing in people who will talk about paper. We even have a woman from Montreal who will be showing how she actually letterpresses on 35-millimeter film and then records it. Wow. So lots of stuff going on this weekend.
There's a huge interest in type design, it seems like, in recent years, and people are doing everything from casting their own metal type. One of my family members does that, actually, and people are using their computers and pre-prepared computer programs to design their new fonts. How do we get this big love for the fonts these days?
I think in some ways you almost have to thank the computer because previously, before the personal computer, choices of fonts were so limited that people really didn't think about it. You would order your printing and your printer or possibly your graphic designer would choose what type to use for you. Well, you know that as soon as you open up your computer, if you set something, whether it's in InDesign or Word, you get to choose all of those fonts. And so I think it's maybe more accessible to the general public, and they are simply more aware of what they've been looking at for years and years. I often tell people that they truly know way more about typography than they realize. And, you know, that comes in the form of advertising, but more basically in terms of communication. And I think we still communicate with words, and that's the thing that sort of carries us through the whole thing. We have this need to communicate with each other, and we realize that certain letters are more effective in certain ways.
This is Wisconsin, so I'm going to throw a beer analogy at you. We've seen a big growth in small breweries, brew pubs, and home craft brewing booming in the last couple decades. Is there something similar going on in the printing world, from hobbies to people setting up independent presses?
Yeah, I think you're onto something exactly right, Rob, because I would liken it to the same thing. People have been brewing beer for a long time, and it's sort of a rediscovery of something that they realize that they can make a little bit more personalized. So many of the microbrews aren't the massive Miller and Bud sort of things. They're more small edition, if you will. And so we're kind of doing the same thing, maybe in less of a sense that we are not mostly commercially operating, much more of rediscovering it as an art form.
Do you and other people in this trade, as you say, it's a living art, it's going into the future, but do people feel this sense of history going back to, you know, Ben Franklin and Gutenberg?
I think they do. And, you know, in the same sense that you may be interested in a brand new building, there are certain foundations of architecture which have stayed true in terms of, say, structure and function. And we deal with the same aspects And so, you know, even if you're Frank Gehry designing a brand new museum, you still have that real respect for those people who built the Acropolis and, you know, the incredible knowledge that they had to kind of create a thing and make it stand up and make it work the way that they needed it to. So I think that respect for it is in some ways no different than a chef being interested in gardening, where, yes, you're creating new recipes, but we still grow potatoes basically the same way. It's just sort of a rediscovery of something that was always there.
The Ways Goose event is sold out, but I think you have a housewarming party coming up. When is that? What's going on?
On December 7th, we will have our grand opening, so that what we will do this weekend is invite our group in. That'll be the first time the museum has been open, but what we would like to do is kind of invite the general public as well. And so on the 7th, we'll be taking people through the museum. They'll get to see demonstrations of printing and really just seeing the new space. It's much bigger than it was before, and one of the great things is it's still in an old factory. The building that we bought, which overlooks Lake Michigan, is from the 50s, and I think there's some great factory aspects of it, because in the end, printing, I believe, is an industrial art, and if the setting looks industrial, so much the better. I think when you look at a lot of museums, in a sense, their collections are out of context, meaning that they've been brought in and merely displayed, whereas with ours, if it looks like it did when someone was actually running that press or setting that type, that's just that much better for us. It gives the visitor more of the feel for the working museum that we are.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Rob. I sure appreciate the chance to let people know what's going on.
That was Jim Moran, director of the Hamilton Woodtype Museum. As he mentioned, there's a housewarming party there after its recent move coming up a month from tomorrow, December 7th.
And coming up, roller derby is wheeling into Milwaukee this weekend as the city hosts an international championship event. We'll find out about the rising profile of the sport. That's coming up on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk about the possible end of residency requirements for Milwaukee city workers with Mayor Tom Barrett.
But first, we're focusing on another event in Milwaukee, roller derby championships.
This weekend, the best roller derby skaters from around the world will be in Milwaukee to compete for the Hydra Trophy.
And here to explain what the Hydra is and how roller derby is played is our guest, Irish Vixen. We'll call her IV for short. She's a skater for the Brew City Bruisers, the league in Milwaukee. Ivy, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about what this championship is in Milwaukee this weekend.
Sure. It's the international championship where we'll have 14 teams battling it out for the Hydra, which is the number one thing that these 14 teams want to receive. It's really the best of the best coming out. We're really excited to have this opportunity to be hosting this event. And it's a great opportunity for locals to come out and see these amazing athletes bout it out for the trophy.
So what is roller derby? How is it played?
That is an often asked question. roller derby is a full contact sport. There's two 30-minute periods. During those 30-minute periods of time, we have what's called jams. Now, the jams could last up to 2 minutes each. And during that time, we have five players from each team. Four of them are blockers, and one of them is what's called a jammer. And these jammers are battling to get through the pack to not only be hopefully called the lead jammer, but they want to get through the pack and come back around for more laps. Every time they lap an opposing player, they get 1 point. So they want to try to obtain as many points as they can during that 2 minute period of time. There's a lot of strategy behind roller derby. So not only when you're on the track, you're playing offense and defense at the same time. The blockers want to help get their jammer through the pack as smoothly as possible, as legally as possible. And the opposing, they want to stop the opposing jammer. So it's a contact sport with a lot of strategy.
I should know this, but is roller derby always women?
There is women's roller derby, but we also have men's roller derby.
Are they as high profile as the women's is right now?
No. They're certainly coming up within ranks, and the men are forging their own movement through roller derby. But our focus is fully women. We do have men that help us out, but it's really a women's initiative, a women's sport that the Bruce City Bruisers and WIFTA that's hosting this international championship is all about.
So there was a big derby craze, I dimly recall, back in the 1970s. What's different from that to today?
That's another great question. The sport of roller derby has definitely evolved throughout the years. I think that when I mention I play roller derby, or someone says roller derby, they think about the 1970s, they think about the 1980s, where maybe they were sitting in their basements watching TV and saying, hey, I saw so-and-so punch somebody. It was much more of an entertainment component to roller derby during those times, which was wonderful. But when roller derby started back up in the late 2000s, it was really about making the sport about that amateur athlete and really empowering women to play a sport and be seen as an athlete. So although roller derby still has some fun components to it, which is great because that's part of our history, such as, you know, alter ego names and characters. The focus of roller derby now is much more about an athlete and watching an athlete grow and progress.
It seems like it's really cresting again. I was driving down one of the streets near my home, and I saw a bunch of women out practicing in formation the other day. You know, they skate in big venues. What accounts do you think for the popularity that's cresting again for roller derby?
And that's so wonderful to hear. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that roller derby is really a grassroots movement. It's women coming in and running the leagues themselves. And because it's an amateur sport, you know, they're taking their time, they're investing their time away from their families, work, even their own personal lives to forge together and make this passion that they have for roller derby succeed. And I think that's what is so exciting about it and what's really driving the popularity towards roller derby.
You've kind of touched on this a little, but why do you think this has really resurged as such a powerful female, a women's movement in derby?
Again, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that these women have a say in how the sport is played, how the sport is trained, where they'd like to see roller derby go. There's a lot of, you know, just diversity and all sorts of groups of women getting together with different backgrounds and coming together to that have this one passion, and it's roller derby, and they want to see it succeed. And you know, women, we don't like failure. We want to see things succeed. So I think just the drive that we all have towards the love of the sport.
Now, you talked about this being a showcase for amateur athletes. And so I wonder, how tough do you have to be to make it on a derby team as a woman?
I think it's not so much as being tough as it is to being determined and having this inner, what I call X factor, is knowing as that you want to play on a team. Roller derby really is a team sport. It's not an individual sport. One individual can't help make you win. It really takes a collective group of individuals as your teammates to make your team successful. So I think that has really helped with that movement and encouraging people to
But you have to work out a lot, go to the gym, lift weights, run.
Yes. Well, you know, again, it depends on how good you want your team to be and how good you want to be for your team. You know, so there are a lot of women that do a lot of off skates. There's a lot of conditioning. There's a lot of times where you're learning how to fall properly, how to hit properly. There's a lot of illegal hitting going on. And that's why we have refs and others to make sure that when we're doing something wrong, we go in the penalty box. But the number one thing about roller derby is that we're doing it safely, and that we're hitting each other safely, and that, you know, we're not out there intentionally trying to hurt ourselves or one another.
So is this mostly an American thing? Are you seeing, this is an international championship. How much attention is this getting outside of the U.S.?
That's what's so exciting is that it's definitely grown more internationally. When it started back up in the 2000s, a group of women in Texas started it back up. It was kind of then reborn in the States. But we have London coming out, and some of the top leagues are from Canada, and it's growing all over. A lot of European countries and Australia, and it's just really exciting to see this boom surge of the league starting up all across the world.
You mentioned this Hydra Trophy. What is that? Why is it called the Hydra?
It was actually named after one of the founders that started what is known as the Women's Flat Track Derby Association. Her name was Hydra. And so in honor of her being our first president of that governing body, the trophy is named after her.
How excited are you that this big event is here in Wisconsin, over in Milwaukee?
I cannot express to you how excited I am. I keep telling everybody that, well, first of all my family and friends outside of Derby think I'm crazy. But my analogy is twofold. One, I say I feel like a five-year-old boy that is about to meet all of his favorite superheroes. I'm losing sleep. I'm at work. I'm thinking about how I might be breathing the same air as some of these amazing athletes, and I'm so excited. And then also, I think, oh gosh, when I actually see one of these teams or one of these skaters, am I going to scream at the top of my lungs like a 13-year-old girl at a One Direction concert? I don't know. I might. And so I am so excited. I'm so excited for it to be here in Milwaukee and the opportunity for the city. So
wondering what's next for roller derby. Wasn't there some talk a while back about it becoming an Olympic event? Would you like to see that?
I sure hope so. I know that the Derby community would love to see that. We do have Team USA and other countries that are forging larger teams to bout in certain tournaments that would be a little bit more of an international tournament that would be outside of this championship tournament that we have going on. So I think that the Derby community and their fans would love to see something like that in the Olympics, and hopefully that can happen one day.
All right, at this big competition in Milwaukee, who are the teams to beat? Give us a couple of your favorite contenders.
Oh, okay. Well, that's hard to say because I'm so excited about them all. and they all bring different pieces and different strengths and weaknesses. I'm a big fan of London. That's just me personally, because I feel like they've been working so hard since back 2011. They've been kind of the underdogs. They're international, and they've been working really hard. I think Angel City from California, we played them earlier this year. They beat us. They were so amazing, and they have really great attitudes. The favorite always within the Derby community and the previous champion winners is Gotham. They're just unstoppable, and they do great. And, of course, I'm going to give a shout-out to our sister league, the Windy City Roller Girls. They are amazing, and they hold a special place in our hearts. But there's a lot of great teams. There's 14 amazing teams that are going to be here this weekend, and if locals have an opportunity, they should come and check it out.
All right, Ivy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Irish Vixen, Ivy for short, a skater for the Brew City Bruisers, the Derby League in Milwaukee.
Coming up next, we're talking to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about the possible end of residency requirements for city workers there. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.